You can't get out and dig in the dirt right now, but today is a great day for planning. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and time for a mental break from the cold. We'll start planning for spring. Anne-Marie van der Zenden is a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. She specializes in creating functional, sustainable, and beautiful landscapes. If you have a yard that's a blank slate or a yard you'd like to transform, today is a great day to get some ideas for how to pick the right plants and create the kind of environment you want. Richard Geron of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture will also be here to tell you how to take care of the plants you already have. Join our conversation with your questions and ideas after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and on the coldest day of the year, so far at least, it's a great opportunity to do some collective daydreaming and start planning for the spring. Richard Geron of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture will be here in a few minutes to answer your plant-related questions. But we're going to start off today with Anne-Marie van der Zenden. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and she specializes in creating functional, sustainable, and beautiful landscapes. So if you have a yard that you would like to transform in some way or another and you're making plans, please join our conversation. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Anne-Marie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
You bet. It was nice to come in someplace warm this morning.
Yes. Coming inside is a special treat on a day like today,
you
isn't
bet.
It? Well, let's talk about outside, though. So if you're starting a landscaping project, where do you even begin?
You know, that is such an important question. And I think sometimes people are afraid to even start because they don't know where to begin. When I work with clients or talk to different people, and certainly when I work with my students on campus, one of the first things that I try to get them to do when they're thinking about a design, particularly for themselves, is to look at different examples of designs they like. So either using some of the different magazines like Fine Gardening or Garden Design, looking at local types of magazines that you'll see in Iowa, like Iowa Gardening or some of those. Anything that has really nice pictures, I think that people can look at those and see what they like about a design. Maybe in one design, it's the way that the plant materials are combined. They like the colors or the textures. In another design, they can see how the landscape works with the house, and they can see the relation to their own house because it's a similar style. So that's another good place to start. Maybe it's another picture they see and they really like the way the circulation patterns are laid out, the way the patio comes off the back of the house and the sidewalk or the path connects the front of the house to the back of the house. And so I think once people have an idea of the types of pieces of the landscape they like, then they can start to figure out how to pull those different kind of separate elements together to make something that is really suitable to them and to their particular site.
Now, of course, there are a lot of things you can do to change the landscape in your yard as far as putting in patios and walkways and building up certain areas of the yard, putting in a berm, all kinds of different things. But how much do you think you need to think about the land that's already there and working with what you already have?
I think one of the most important things for people to consider is that point that you just made. Anytime that you can work with the existing site that you have as much as possible, that's going to be beneficial for a couple of reasons. The first is it's going to cost a little bit less. So anytime you have to come in and do a lot of earthwork, so you're moving soil and you're sculpting the land and you're putting in large berms or you're doing a lot of that type of work, that really adds to the cost. So for an example, if you've got a slope in your backyard that's a little bit too steep to mow, the kids run down it and they fall down and that's not good, or you just want to make it into a more usable space, rather than trying to make it into the entire area being level, you can make a couple of smaller retaining walls and then make it the area so it has a little bit of slope but is a little bit easier to use.
Okay, so terrace it gently and work with the land a little bit.
Right, terrace it, and so you may have a little bit more expense in one area, but trying to make everything level, and then you'd have to end up building a taller retaining wall, which would be more expensive, would increase your cost. So that certainly is one way. If there's another area that you do want to create a berm, rather than bringing in soil from another site, you can use soil on your existing site, and maybe you're going to excavate out for a patio area. Use some of that soil to create the berm in a different area on your land. So trying to kind of recycle and reuse existing features on the site can be helpful as well.
Well, it also sounds like you're recommending that people really plan ahead. Do you recommend trying to get an idea of the whole picture of what you want to do before you start in little pieces?
Yes, definitely. That's one of the other pieces. If you can think kind of in a more of a master plan type of a mindset, you know, where do you want the landscape to be in 5 years or even in 10 years? And then once you have kind of that plan in place, you can start building some of the smaller pieces one piece at a time. If you have that kind of roadmap, if you will, it's going to make it less likely you're going to have to redo something or to change something partway through the project. It also gives you some guidelines. So when you go to the nursery in the spring, you buy the plants that you need rather than just everything that looks great, which is really hard to do after a long Iowa winter. You want to just buy a little bit of everything. It also helps you figure out what types of hard goods you need to purchase and some of those other types of more broad decisions you need to make early on.
When you talk about looking at pictures and looking at other people's yards and sort of taking the pieces that you like from what other people have and putting them together, when you pull those pieces together, how do you make it into a cohesive plan so that it all works?
The best way to do that is to use some of the really basic principles of design. So using things like line and balance, and some of those would be two examples to start with, you can create something that is more cohesive. So for example, on line, you choose curvilinear bed lines. So rather than have everything in a row with set angles, you choose the more sweeping, more gentle types of bed line curves. And then you can tie that in with the shape of your patio. So rather than have a patio that's square, you decide to make it into a circle patio or something like that. Your pathways, rather than being the straightest distance or the shortest distance between two points and being a straight line, you put a nice curve in that so you kind of experience a little bit of the garden as you move from one place to the other. And then when you have the bed lines that have these similar curves, then all of those elements will start to look like they belong together.
So come up with, again, that overall plan before you start putting in the elements.
Right. So creating that master plan or that roadmap helps you figure out not only where your planting beds or your deck or your walkways are going to go, but also the shape that they're going to be in.
Do you have any tools that you really like to use, or do you sit down with a pencil and paper and draw out a plan?
You know, I usually sit down with a pencil and paper. One of my favorite things to do, though, is I like to look at landscapes in the elevational view. And so that's the view that you get when you're standing, you know, on the sidewalk in front of your house and looking at it. I like to take a photograph and then just print it out, change the contrast so it's nice and light, and then make 4 or 5 copies of it, and then just start doodling and drawing the different shapes of the trees or the shrubs or the you know, a pergola or something like that, so I can get a sense of how it's going to look when I would view it normally. And then I'll take it and put it into plan view, and that's the view when you're kind of standing above a site looking down on it. It's the bird's eye view. That's where you can start to see how the shapes start to relate to each other, and the shape of the patio or the beds or the walkways, and how much space a bed takes up versus how much space the turf area takes up. And so going back and forth between those two helps me as a designer, because I need to have different dimensions when I'm looking at things.
You talk about drawing in the shapes of the plants, and when you look at pictures, when you see your neighbor's yard, you see these plants all over the place, and of course you have a lot of knowledge to draw on. For a lot of us, though, we just see a pretty plant. How do you go about figuring out what's what?
Well, the what's what, you might have to ask your neighbor what the plant actually is. But as far as drawing it, like in the elevation view, you're really just drawing the form of the plant. So it's just like drawing stick people. It's really quite simple. So either it's kind of rounded or it's kind of oval or it's kind of this irregular mass. It certainly doesn't have to be pretty, but you just want it to kind of represent the overall shape of the plant and the amount of space it would take up, the three-dimension space that it's going to take up in the landscape. I can tell you, when I do an exercise with my students, and we start drawing, the first amount of time I give them is about 2 minutes to draw a tree. And then I give them a minute, and then we have 20 seconds. And then at the end, I only give them 5 seconds to draw a tree. It's amazing what they can do.
So you could actually take that plan to a garden center or something like that and say, I want a plant that's this shape, and maybe get advice on what to choose that way as well.
Right. So think, for example, of your front entryway. So you want to really frame that up and make that the focal point so people know when they drive up to your house, this is where their attention is drawn. Maybe you don't know exactly what plant you want there, but you've got an idea of the shape. So maybe you want something that's kind of pyramidal in shape right on either side of your door. And then you want some kind of rounded shrubs next to those. And then in front of that, something kind of low growing like a ground cover. You know, we've got fantastic nursery and landscape professionals in this state, and they can help you with that actual plant selection. If you can tell them the function, kind of what you want that plant to do in the landscape, and then a little bit about the color or the texture of it, they can give you a list of 3 or 4 things to choose from. When the weather's fantastic, you can walk through the nursery and say, yep, that's the one I want. This is the one I want. And then you'll be able to have that small little design area all ready to go.
Of course, we all want instant gratification when we put together a project like this. Are there some pitfalls that people fall into if they buy plants that are fast growing because they know they'll get results quickly and then those plants kind of take over the landscape?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. That is one of the problems. You know, plants are like puppies. They will grow. You just need to give them a little bit of time. And what happens is people do tend to overplant. So they do have a landscape that looks like it's been there longer than it actually has. There's a couple of problems with one is the landscape does get overcrowded. Then you can potentially end up with disease problems because the air can't circulate around the plants. You'll also end up with plants that are larger and more aggressive that can outcompete some of those slower growing plants, which may actually be the plants that you really want to showcase at some point. And if that's the case, then you end up having to do a whole lot of pruning on the plants to kind of keep them in line, which creates a lot of green waste, which isn't a particularly sustainable
way
to landscape.
A whole lot of work as
well.
We'll continue talking about landscaping in a moment. My guest is Anne-Marie van der Zenden. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist, will be here as well. And we'd love to hear your questions. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, a wonderful day to start thinking about getting out in the garden, being that it's the coldest day of the year so far. My guests are Anne-Marie van der Zenden. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. And also Richard Geron is here from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And we would love to hear from you as well with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And so far, we've been talking about landscaping and planning for your yard for the spring. If you have a blank slate, if you have a yard you want to transform and you want to talk about ideas, if you have questions, give us a call, 866-780-9100. But of course, you can call us with any of your plant-related questions. And Anne-Marie, before we move off of the topic of landscaping, are there elements, landscaping elements, that you feel are overdone right now?
You know, I think that what I've seen in the industry over the last 10 or 15 years is kind of trends that come and go. There for a while, things were really focused in on really different types of planting combinations. I think most recently the focus has been related to different types of hardscapes in the landscape, be it patios or walkways or decks. Fire pits are certainly very popular, as are water features. I think as people are looking at their home landscape as a place to escape to, partly due to the economics of our current economy, I think people are looking to create an outdoor space where they can really spend time and enjoy being there. And in order to do that, they're putting in some really nice features like these outdoor kitchens and just creating an outdoor space that's comfortable that you can be in for an extended period of time.
It seems like there are lots and lots of pitfalls that people can fall into with water features. Maybe that's just a personal phobia of mine, that I think that if we put a water feature in our yard, we wouldn't take care of it and we'd wind up with a lot of mosquitoes. But do you see people falling into pitfalls with those?
You know, I think it's one of those things you just need to go into it with your eyes wide open. You need to know, depending upon the type of water feature you put in and the size and the scale of it, it's going to come with certain issues that need to be addressed. You know, if you've got one of the pondless water features where the water is held in an underground reservoir, you don't end up with some of the problems of the other types of ponds where you've got the big above ground water reservoir where you would see your fish and those types of things. They obviously aren't going to look quite the same than the typical ponds or streams, but they do tend to be a little bit easier to manage, but they still are not without maintenance. You still need to clean the filter and do some annual maintenance on it to make sure that the pump continues to work. So we actually, Cindy Haynes, a colleague of mine, and Rich Clayton, who is a former Extension faculty member here at Iowa State, are just finishing up a publication on ornamental water features for the Midwest. And water features can be a great addition all over the country, but in the Midwest, obviously, we have certain considerations with our temperatures that we need to be concerned about.
Now, of course, a lot of people want to keep the cost down when they're doing landscaping by doing a lot of it themselves, and a lot of people really enjoy doing a lot of it themselves. Are there some elements that you would warn people against, or warn people to at least make sure that they get thoroughly educated about before they try to attempt them themselves?
Most definitely. There are, I think with landscaping, because so many people are involved in gardening on some level or another, they often have a sense that they can do a lot of it themselves. And in some cases, they certainly can. But when it comes to things related to grading changes or anything that is going to be using a water supply, certainly anything that brings in electrical elements like night lighting or those types of things, I would really encourage them to learn as much as they can about it, but also know their limitations and contact a local contractor. Many of the contractors are willing to work with people to help them do parts and pieces that are outside of the homeowner's scope, but leave some of the other pieces for the homeowner that they can manage. So I think finding the right contractor is a really important step. And sometimes working with a design professional, either a landscape architect or a landscape designer, you can really get a good idea of what that master plan might look like. Those professionals have the skills and the experience to be able to envision what a site could be and what the long-term potential is for it. And then maybe there's an opportunity for the homeowner to do some of those pieces, the actual installation or choosing some of the plant materials that really reflect their own personal preferences. So, you know, and it can be a very reasonable investment. When you think about the landscape for a home, oftentimes it's related to the value of the home when you get ready to sell it. Certainly the curb appeal is important, but putting a little bit of time and money and making that investment, I think, can really enhance not only your own personal enjoyment, but certainly the way that the landscape looks. And if you're going to be selling your property at some point, be able to help you bring in the high value for it.
We're talking about landscaping ideas today, and we're also talking about any of the plant issues you want to bring up. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. And we have a question from Joe in Boone County. He says, I have several large garden plots and would like to move to a no-till system. Would it be possible to use a cover plant like white clover between rows to keep weeds down while providing a green manure? Richard?
Well, you can use certain green manure crops. Just make sure that they don't go to seed if they produce seed, and maybe cut them back right before they do go to seed, and maybe incorporate those into the soil. So you can, but you could also use like a mulch between rows, things like shredded leaves, grass clippings, and that way you can walk through the area. You don't have to worry about weeds. You won't get muddy. And then those materials can actually be worked into the soil in the fall, too. So you're adding organic matter to the soil.
Okay, so if you used a cover plant like white clover, you'd have to maintain a large enough space that you'd be able to mow it? Or what are you suggesting as far as cutting it off before the seeds?
Well, with Dutch white clover, that's a perennial type plant. You could have it just there and let it go to seed. A lot of things like, for example, buckwheat and certain other plants might go to seed, and you would typically want to cut those back before they go to seed.
Okay. We have another email. I'm guessing Kathy's been thumbing through some nursery catalogs that have been coming her way. I'm wondering if a hardy pecan tree will really grow well and produce in central Iowa. I'd also like to know if there are any varieties of hazelnut that will do well here. I've heard there are bush varieties. Is that better than a tree type?
Well, as far as pecans, they are actually native to far southeast Iowa. We can grow them into central Iowa, but oftentimes in central Iowa, they typically don't produce fruit. They're so far north that they survive, they grow, but oftentimes they produce very little in the way of fruit. So it's possible, but they may not produce a lot of fruit. As far as the hazelnuts, we can grow those. The actual American hazelnut is native to the United States. We can grow that. It's a shrub. Grows typically around 6 to 8 foot tall. We can grow that in sun to part shade. The big problem with the hazelnuts is that as the nuts mature, the squirrels are looking, and oftentimes they beat you to the shrubs. But we can grow the Native American hazelnut.
Okay, so you can get a crop as long as you're really fast?
Right. And learn to share.
All right. Dinah's on the line from Ames. Hello, Dinah. Dinah, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay. I have a question. A couple of years ago, I had some. I planted some onions that were very successful, and somehow in harvesting them, I missed a couple of bulbs. Last year, they went to seed, and I decided that since I had liked how they did so well, I decided to save the seed. And I would like to know how I can start those more successfully this year and try growing the same onions this year.
I would sow them directly in the ground in April.
Okay.
I would just go out probably around mid-April, take the seed, and direct seed the onions right in the ground in mid-April.
My understanding was, though, that they put a lot of their bulb on a little earlier in the summer. So would I have as nice an onion if I do that?
You should have. Many varieties have a long growing season, but if you put them in the ground in mid-April, they have the rest of April, May, June, July, August. So they have a long growing period. So they should develop into a nice onion.
Okay.
All right. Well, Dinah, thank you so much for your call.
I don't have to chill the seed or anything like that to get them to grow?
No, just keep them nice and dry.
Okay.
In a cool place and nice and dry.
Okay.
If they're kind of in a damp or moist spot, they might rot. But
okay.
if they're kept dry, they should be fine.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. Richard, why don't more people start onions from seeds?
Well, with seed, it's a little bit more difficult. You may get uneven germination. They may come in very thick, very thin. You have the other options where you have little onion plants. That's almost foolproof. You just plant those and they grow. The same with sets. So oftentimes people go with the sets and plants. It's easier.
All right. We have a question by email, and you're welcome to join us with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this is one that both of you might want to weigh in on, and it's a question that a lot of people are asking right now as the emerald ash borer has been found on an island in the Mississippi River. The question is, I have three large ash trees and would like to start some replacement to be trees near them. How far away does a new seedling tree need to be planted to get enough sun until my ash trees end up as firewood in the future years?
Well, I would plant them beyond the drip line or canopy of the ash trees, so they are not basically growing underneath them, either partially or fully. So I would plant beyond the canopies of the ash trees.
And Anne-Marie, when you're selecting trees for your property, of course, that's something that you're thinking very long-term about. Do you have any suggestions for how to select the right trees to, and in this case, to replace a beautiful ash tree?
You know, there's so many trees that we can grow in Iowa. There's a number of them, really, that are, I think, are kind of underused. So much of that selection, though, ultimately depends on the function of that plant in the landscape, or that tree specifically in the landscape, and then the site conditions. So if you've got an area where you want to create some type of summer shading, so you're going to put it on the south and west side of the house, you'll need to choose a plant that has a large dense canopy and then locate it in such a way that you actually get some type of shading effect onto the house. If you've got an area that is, part shade that needs to be addressed, you need to choose plants that are going to fit into that area. Oftentimes we think of most trees being able to grow in full sun, but if they're planted when they're young and there's other large trees around them, they also are going to have to be growing in some part shade for a while until they get to be large enough to, you know, to take their place in the landscape. So I would just, there's a number of resources online that people can look at. We also have an extension publication on choosing landscape plants for the Midwest. And it's just a listing of plant materials specifically for our growing climates. It's divided by size and whether or not the plants are evergreen and deciduous, and then unique features as to why you might choose that plant. Say, for example, it has great fall color. It sets fruit or it doesn't set fruit, depending upon whether or not you want to attract wildlife or you're planning to plant it next to a sidewalk or something like that. So, yeah, I would certainly look at some of those resources. But thinking, I guess, largely or overall when you start about what the role of the plant in the landscape is going to be.
Well, and we have seen diseases like Dutch elm disease go through where we're seeing the emerald ash borer moving closer, and probably most, if not all, of the ash trees in the state of Iowa will be gone in a decade. Would you suggest picking three different kinds of trees just to hedge your bets?
You bet. I certainly would. I am all about trying to find some type of diversity in the landscape. I think, ash trees were planted extensively because they can grow in really poor growing conditions. Many times urban sites have disturbed soils, they have compacted soils, they have heat island effects. You know, they have a lot of things that are hard for a lot of trees to grow in. So ash trees grow well and have grown well. And I think that's why we saw such a proliferation of them, particularly in urban landscapes. I think as I look around the landscape, I see a similar potential problem with a lot of the red maples that have been planted. Again, another fantastic tree, but we need to have a little bit of genetic diversity in the landscape. So if there is another Dutch elm disease type of outbreak, or like we're seeing now with emerald ash borer, if you have a more diverse landscape, you're not going to lose all the plants to whatever that pathogen is.
All right. Charlie's on the line in West Des Moines with a question at 866-780-9100. Hello, Charlie.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
There's a person in central Iowa that was growing a type of nut tree. It's like a Japanese variety of nut tree, and growing that for profit. I was wondering if you're familiar with that breed, and if you could give advice if that was a hardy tree for Iowa.
Boy, I have not heard that, so I'm not familiar with that. You don't know the type of tree?
Well, that's what I was hoping you'd help me with.
No, I really haven't heard that, so I'm not sure.
And then this was in the Adel area?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe a listener can help us out with this, if you know.
Okay. Do you have internet access?
Yes.
You may want to go online, go to Google. There is a Iowa Nut Growers Association. Find their website. Maybe contact a person with the organization, see if they know.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, good luck with that, Charlie. And again, yeah. if you know what Charlie's talking about, a Japanese nut tree that someone was producing in the Adel area, give us a call and let us know. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also call with your questions. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Today we've been talking a lot about landscaping, thinking about spring, and if you have a yard that you want to transform this year or a landscape you'd like to tweak a little bit, if you have any questions for Anne-Marie van der Zenden, give us a call, 866-780-9100, or with any of your other planning for the spring activities, if you're thinking about your garden or thinking about some plants that you need to take special care of this year, give us a call. Richard Giron is here from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture to answer your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you're welcome to join our conversation with any of your plant-related questions. We've been talking about landscaping ideas, so if you have any questions about your landscaping projects that you hope to be starting in April or May, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100, or if you have any other plant-related questions as well, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talks and email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guests today are Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension Horticulture and Anne-Marie van der Zenden. She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. And first up, we've got LJ in Fort Dodge. Hello.
Hi. Been a chef for the past like 20 years now, and I know we've been doing a lot here in Iowa about growing grapes for wine and things like that. And I was wondering what the possibility of growing olive trees would be where most of European nations, they're growing grapes and olives kind of hand in hand. Is that something that would be even considered feasible here in Iowa, as harsh as our winters can get?
As far as olives, no, we just can't grow those. We don't have the right climate for that.
That's what I was kind of afraid of.
Well, it was worth a shot, right?
Yeah, there's one more of those things we could kind of publicize and do both culinarily and agricultural-wise, I was
right.
kind of hoping.
Right. Well, we'll have to find another angle. Thanks a lot for your call, LJ.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
They like more of a Mediterranean-type climate, and ours is more of a cold continental climate. They just don't adapt well. So
even on the shores of Lake Okoboji, it wouldn't really.
I don't think so, no.
All right. We have another question along the same lines, and this is reinforcing my theory that a lot of people are looking at nursery catalogs and seeing some really attractive ideas in there. This is Ryan from Reasoner. He says, I'm wondering about hardy kiwi. I'm looking at Arctic Beauty cultivar as one of the hardiest varieties I can find, and was wondering if you had any experience.
Well, as far as the kiwis, they've been tried for a number of years in Iowa, especially the varieties that were grown for the fruit. As far as fruit, they never really did much. Oftentimes, they tended to die back quite a bit, and they just didn't produce any fruit. So the fruit-producing varieties didn't do very well. But if you want to plant an ornamental type for the foliage, that's a little bit different story, because even if they die back some, they'll be okay. They'll typically come back. So it's worth a shot, but they may die back if we have a really bad winter, but they should come back from the base, and so that may occur periodically.
Okay, and so your fruit production may not be...
Yeah, fruit production, I wouldn't plan on that. they haven't really worked out very well. But as an ornamental, I think they have a better future.
Okay. All right. Eldon is on the line from Atkins now. Hello, Eldon. Eldon, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What's your question?
I wondered about what I might be able to put on pre-emergence. I had a perennial garden that giant ragweed got in control of last summer, and I wanted to know if there's something I might put down real early to help keep those under control.
In a garden situation?
Well, a flower garden.
Well, you can use a pre-emergent as far as what's available to a homeowner. Typically, preen is widely sold, and you can use that. But realize it has limitations. It may prevent some weed seed germination, but not all. So you have to be realistic about it. I think another good approach is to use a mulch, like wood chips, shredded leaves, grass clippings, because many weed seeds need light for germination. And so if you cover the ground with like 2 or 3 inches of mulch, the ground doesn't receive sunlight. They don't germinate. Very few weed seeds germinate at that point. So you could try that. You could also use cultivation, where you go out there periodically and just cultivate and destroy the little seedlings before they get big. So you do have a number of options. You can use a pre-emergent, but realize that it's not going to prevent all weed seed germination. You'll still have a few weeds.
The gentleman that called about the nut, it's possible, but I'm not sure, that it might be the Japanese walnut or referred to as a heart nut. And I see those in different, nursery publications.
All right. Well,
That could be. Yeah. Yes, that could be.
All right.
Thank
maybe
you.
Charlie's listening and got that from you, Eldon. Thanks a lot. Next up, we have Stephanie in Manchester. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi. I'm hoping you can help with a disagreement between my husband and I. We have extremely sandy soil, and we are trying to get grass to grow. He wants to fertilize, and I think we need to add organic material first. I'm afraid if we fertilize when it rains because of the sandiness of the soil, that all the fertilizer will basically just wash away.
Well, if you want to improve the soil dramatically, you're going to have to destroy what's there, the existing grass, bring in some organic matter like compost or some good soil, apply it to the area like maybe 2 or 3 inches, maybe more, and then work that into the existing soil and then restart your lawn. You can definitely do that. And
I don't really want to do that because we're talking a couple of acres.
Okay. So I guess my approach would be to then maybe try just some ordinary common bluegrass varieties. There are many, many, many bluegrass varieties. And most of those that you see at the garden center are meant for high-maintenance lawns. Lawns that are fertilized maybe 3 or 4 times. Lawns that may be irrigated during the summer. And if you have like 2 acres, you really don't want that. You want a low-maintenance type grass. And there are some low-maintenance bluegrass varieties. And I would look for these maybe at a farm and home store. And, for example, South Dakota Common is a bluegrass variety. It's a low-maintenance bluegrass variety. And if I had 2 acres, I'd prefer that because that does well with low maintenance. It tends to be more drought-tolerant than the high-maintenance varieties. You don't have to fertilize it that much, and it still looks presentable. It looks nice. It's not as dark green as some of the high-maintenance varieties, but it still looks nice. And if you have 2 acres, that would be my thought, where maybe I might want to try to establish a low-maintenance bluegrass variety and have something that I really don't have to give much care beyond just basically mowing it.
Okay, and you said that was South Dakota Common?
South Dakota Common, right.
Well, that sounds like a good middle ground between you and your husband, Stephanie. That
yes, it does.
And I was thinking about bringing in 2 or 3 inches of topsoil and compost and working it into the soil. Now, that would be marriage therapy to do that together.
Yeah,
so.
That's a lot of work.
That could create some more disagreements, possibly.
Exactly, yep.
All right. Well, good luck, Stephanie.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you could send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Richard Click and Clack could take some lessons from you. You didn't stir that up at all. You really helped out. Well done.
He did do a nice job, didn't he?
Absolutely. You could find a sideline. Kay is on the line in Davenport. Hello, Kay.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about protection for birds around the bird feeder. We have it in our backyard, the bird feeders. However, we've got some hawks and owls that come right in on top of them while they're trying to feed. And we have special conditions. We have a timber behind the bird feeders, and we have an open field to the west and a lot of wind. And so I'm wondering what we can plant in there where the birds can hide when these predators come in.
What's a plant? That's a hard question to answer. I don't really know offhand.
You know, one suggestion I might have is to be able to put some large, I don't know the specifics of your site, but if you could put some large shrubs or some small trees near where the feeders are, things that would interfere with the hawk and the owl's flight path, and a place that the birds could, you know, jump into and be able to hide in those twigs if there's something that's, one of the predators is starting to fly in. That may be one possibility. But if you've got timber and open space, that's going to be difficult to do much to protect them. So a large shrub or something like that near the feeder might be a possibility.
Okay, that sounds good. Evergreens the best?
Probably, but if you could also certainly do a really dense branched shrub like a large viburnum or even a small crabapple or something like that. And both of those actually would set fruit, so that would be another food source for the songbirds or the other birds that you're trying to attract.
Okay, that sounds great. Thanks for your help.
All right. Sure. Thanks a lot for your call, Kay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Chuck is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Chuck.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, what would you like to ask about?
Well, we have 2 large walnut trees in our backyard. We noticed that it alternates like every other year. There's a bumper crop, and like this year there were none. Is there anything you can do to cut down on the amount of walnuts you get from year to year? You know, like, I mean, what do you do with them? We don't really want them.
Well, there's really no way to prevent the trees from producing fruit. It's not uncommon for many of the fruit trees, the nut trees, to kind of bear in alternate years, because when they're producing a heavy crop, all their resources go into the development of that crop, and oftentimes they don't produce many flowers. The actual flowers form during the summer, early fall, and so they're present in the fall, and then they bloom the following spring. But if they're producing a really big crop that year, they tend not to produce a lot of flowers. So the next year tends to be a small crop. There's really no way to prevent them from producing fruit. You simply have to deal with it when they do. The only way to really prevent them is to cut them down. So
Well, we hate to cut them down. They're beautiful.
Right. So I would probably just live with it. And when they do produce heavily, just go out there and pick them up.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Chuck. And, of course, the squirrels enjoy those as well.
Yes, they do.
and they can have all the black walnuts in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not a black walnut fan.
But you may have more trees in the future,
yeah.
too.
Yes. Steve is on the line now in Dubuque. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I bought a house, and it had a tree in it. I was told it's a pear tree. and I'm assuming that it is, and the thing keeps leaning to the east, towards the house. It's a really nice tree. Now it's like almost 20 feet tall. I've tied it back to try and straighten it up in previous years, and the thing just keeps coming towards the house. Can you prune that, or how do you get that thing to grow straight?
Well, you can definitely prune it and try to shape it up so it looks more presentable, and I'd probably do that in March, early April, before it leaves out. But at this point, it's, I think, too large to pull back. I think that's just not a option. So I would try to prune it so that it's more even, that it looks nice that way. So maybe some branches off the one side and basically nothing off the other side.
That's kind of what I thought, but I wanted to be sure. All right.
What kind of pear tree is it? Is it a an ornamental pear tree or a fruit-bearing fruit or pear tree?
Well, I'm going to say it's ornamental. It gets flowers in the spring, but the fruit's only the size, maybe twice the size of a pea.
Right, that's ornamental.
Yep.
And most of those tend to be very, very symmetrical. So that's kind of surprising that it's leaning in one direction.
I've seen other ones around town, and they look like a pear, like a green pear.
Yep, yeah, they're very symmetrical. Yeah. So I'm not sure why this one is behaving a little bit unusual.
It's leaning a lot. And like I said, I've tied it back in previous years, and it's just bound and determined to go crooked. I don't know.
Does it have a lot of shade on the opposite side from where it's growing? So you said it's leaning to the east. Does it have a lot of shade from the west?
Nope.
Okay.
It's right out in the middle of the yard. It gets sun all day long.
All day long. Because sometimes plants will start to lean towards a light source if they are getting too much shade on one side, but that's clearly not the issue that you have with this tree.
No, it sounds like I get the chainsaw out in about a month, huh?
Well, not a chainsaw. Maybe a pruning saw.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Steve.
Thank you. Bye.
Yep, bye. All right. And we have an email I think we can squeeze in before we have to go. This is from Crystal. She says, do you have any tips or tricks for starting a hothouse to grow some colder weather crops this spring? When can I start the plants and how long does the hothouse need to be in place before I can plant? What varieties and types of crops would you recommend? That's a big question.
Well, I think I'd probably just actually start things indoors. I think that's the simplest way. Just get a fluorescent shop fixture, put in 240-watt tubes, position those about 6 inches above the plants, and you can grow things like tomatoes, peppers, cabbage, broccoli, flowers like petunias and marigolds indoors, and very simple, very inexpensive.
It sounds like she's actually hoping to produce something, I don't know, like lettuce or other early crops. Can you do that in the house without any kind of a special, really special setup?
You can actually do lettuce indoors, too, underneath artificial light.
Okay.
You could do that. As long as it has artificial light, a sunny window would not supply enough light. But if you want to try things like lettuce and spinach indoors, you definitely can.
All right. Well, we do have a couple of callers on the line that wanted to help Kay in Davenport out. One suggesting a crabapple tree is really good to protect songbirds, and another suggesting some shrubbery is a good idea as well. We don't have time to get to those calls, but thank you so much for being here today, and thank you for all of your calls and your emails. Anne-Marie Vanderzenden, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thanks. It was fun to be here.
She's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. You're welcome to come back anytime.
Okay.
And Richard Giron was also here today. Richard, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
From Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. We're still doing Horticulture Day every other week for the depth of the winter months. We'll be back to weekly in March. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa online at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nubby. Coming up Monday, three different tales of fatherhood. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.